Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, how do we know what we know? Can science always offer certainty, or is that just an illusion? Well, joining us is epidemiologist and mathematician Adam Kucharski. He's author of Proof, The Uncertain Science of Certainty. Welcome to the programme, Adam. This is a subject that I find absolutely fascinating because it only takes a moment to think about it, to realise that everything we know, almost everything we know, is through trust. Right? We just trust that the people who are telling us what they know is true. And that's crazy.
And I think that's something that I found fascinating looking back, you know, through the history of not just science, but kind of medicine and law, and even what we see now with kind of the emergence of AI in, you know, how do we accumulate trust in what we're seeing? And then also what happens when that breaks down? I mean, even if you kind of look back historically, a lot of the history of America, there was a lot of kind of amateur mathematicians, and the first draft actually of the US Declaration of Independence was originally, we hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. But they thought that was kind of appealing a bit too much to religion. So Benjamin Franklin, who was a kind of key mathematician, crossed it out and he said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. So it's this idea that, you know, it comes as a fact. We can all just agree that. And of course, it wasn't self-evident. A lot of people didn't agree that everybody was equal. So even, you know, appealing to what feels like this kind of very concrete mathematical language very quickly got them into trouble. And it was something that, you know, when I was years ago doing my master's degree, we were always told, you know, don't say clearly or obviously. They're very dangerous words in the kind of trust me, and actually thinking much more about, you know, well, why do we think things that are true? What convinces us? And importantly, what fails to convince us?
Yeah, because our experience of the world is a very subjective one. And not to get all, you know, philosophical about it, but when I think about the things that I know, that that I can prove myself that are true, they are very, very few. Recently, and I was quite delighted with this, I realized that I can prove that the world is round and not flat. I can actually demonstrate that, right? I can demonstrate that a ball drops from my hand. But beyond that, a lot of the stuff that we take as knowledge is very difficult to be sure of, you know, what the functions of the heart is in the body. I just trust that doctors know what they're talking about here. You know, that stars are far away from us and that they are suns. That is, you know, an obvious fact, and yet it's not. I mean, unless there's no way for me testing that, really. I can look at these stars and see them twinkle, but I can't be sure. And so when you start picking apart all of the knowledge that we have as humans, we realize that actually it's all hugely based on believing what someone else is saying to be a fact. And that means that we're really dependent on others for what we think we know.
I think especially for a lot of these kind of complex systems and complex processes, that balance between, you know, what can we look at ourselves and what do we have to kind of take as given. And I was struck a few years ago, I was at a dinner with a lot of AI, you know, specialists before we kind of saw this enormous explosion. And they were commenting that things like self-driving cars, it's very difficult to explain the decision-making. And that was kind of a problem. And obviously trying to build in and untangle that explanation into an AI algorithm makes it much less efficient. There's a lot of additional work that's required there. And I made this point that kind of struck me that actually in medicine, we have lots of things that we don't fully understand, but we've got sufficient evidence they work. So things like
anesthesia.
Heart defibrillation, anesthesia. Yeah. You know, we can show that if we have these combination of drugs, this is the effect it has. The biological mechanism that explains that, there's still work being done to kind of untangle that. But it's almost like the level of evidence, you know, we know if we do this, we get the effect we need. That's kind of sufficient. Yeah. Defibrillation. Yeah. Someone has a heart that needs resetting. We know that that can have that effect. So I think it's also, you know, not just about the kind of trust we need in, you know, how much do we need to explain it, but also in some cases, just being able to say it works is kind of sufficient. But I think it's also really about where that breaks down, and particularly that kind of trust and skepticism, that it's obviously healthy to have a little bit of your desire for explanation about what we see. But I think, you know, when you look at things like conspiracy theories, often it's sort of taking that to extreme. It's saying, you know, I'm not even going to have any trust that the world is flat. And, you know, even if that proof is outlined to me, I'm not going to engage with it. And it's really, you know, we see that whether you're looking at kind of law or you're looking at evaluating new medicines, it's balancing those risks. If you don't want to believe something that's false, but equally, you don't want to discard something that's true because you're being excessively skeptical.
Yeah. The ancient Greek philosophers, Aristotle and the like, during the times where they're figuring out, you know, how we persuade the masses to do things, they came up with this idea of that if you were to be convincing, you need to use pathos, ethos, and logos. You need to hit someone in the heart and the head and be of credible stature. And these things still hold true today, that if we are an emotional person, like a great storyteller like my mom, and can spin a great yarn, but you don't have the facts straight and, you know, you're prone to exaggeration, you're not necessarily credible. Or if you're like my dad, who's very focused on details as a pilot and doesn't get involved in the engaging communication side of giving you the information, then he's going to be maybe a little less engaging, but a lot more credible. And so it's kind of interesting how we take facts on and what we consider to be facts, because in your book, you kind of talk about, you know, this idea, this search for objectivity. And I'm wondering, what do you believe that there is objectivity out there? Can we say anything is a fact for sure? And what are the criteria that we need to be able to say this absolutely happened? Because of course, in the States, this is being ripped up day by day. What we think is a fact.
I think that's it's a big question. It's an important question. I mean, there's some things that obviously have that element of testability. You know, if you don't believe in gravity, and I believe in gravity, something may very quickly not end very well for you. And there's a kind of testability to that that can kind of show that falsification, your belief. As you mentioned, there's also things that play in. I think a lot of the problems we have are where people's confidence in something being true doesn't align with the wider audience. So even that kind of US example of the assumption that it's self-evident that the people are equal. I mean, Abraham Lincoln in the 1850s grew frustrated with a lot of the people who were supporting slavery. And he had this nice line in the speech that he said, if someone will stand up and reassert that two and two don't make four, I know nothing in the power of argument to stop him. So it's almost like if you get people who just deny that's a fact. And he ended up pointing to some of the voting results that some of these people who were in favor of this were getting hammered. And it was really about those kind of broader elements playing in. And I think that's something where, especially if we look through to the modern era, and we see this across a lot of subjects, where it's not just, even if you run a clinical trial or you have some evidence of a scientific discovery that you have very, very high confidence in, it's also about that element of communication. And I think that's something which, often it's very easy as a scientist to say, oh yeah, the evidence is clear, this is obviously the case. But actually translating that and not just having it as a recited fact, I think is, where there's enormous challenges often from convincing people. I think we're often very good at convincing ourselves, but think a lot less actually about what makes things convincing for other people.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the biggest failings during the COVID era, was that we did not immediately grasp the importance of communicating science, which is different from doing science. And that when we're trying to get people to change their behavior or understand that this is an area of uncertainty, that we don't know exactly what's going on, but these are our best guesses and we should probably go with those because they're based on all the evidence we have. That approach just wasn't satisfactory for people. They believe that we should absolutely know before we make a decision. And I'm wondering, this uncertainty in medicine, how much trouble does it cause when people expect, science to be very clear and definitive 100% about something?
I think particularly in situations when you're under pressure, it can cause a lot of problems. And I think, looking back, when I was researching the book kind of 100 years ago in statistics, there's almost some of these framings that really don't suit real life very well. So if you look back to kind of the early experiments, a lot of it was kind of, arguments over, is it better to put milk into your tea before and afterwards? And these very things where you can design that study. And the way that it was really kind of framed as an experiment was, we might have high confidence that you can tell the difference. But if you have sort of middling level of confidence, you just don't really take a view either way. But life, of course, whether you're talking about a legal case, whether you're talking about a pandemic, you don't get that luxury of just being able to sit back on the fence and say, well, we'll kind of wait and see. That in itself is making a decision. So I think the danger is we can kind of bias ourselves towards kind of doing nothing. And in the legal world, there's this nice term called the weak evidence problem. And it's saying in legal cases, often you won't have very, very high confidence of what the truth is. So you might have a situation where it's extremely unlikely that this death was just a coincidence. It's also extremely unlikely that this person is a murderer. but we have to pick one of those things. And individually, the probability of both those things might be quite low, but one of those is what happened. And we have to have some framework for making those decisions. And I think that's something where, you know, whether we're talking about an emergency like COVID, even if you go back historically, Austin Bradford Hill, who did a lot of the work on smoking and cancer, had this nice line of, yeah, science may be overturned. We may get additional knowledge, but we can't just ignore the knowledge that we've got at this point in time and the action that it might demand.
Yeah, I think people are more tolerable in the world of law because they're seen as an argument and that there's convincing to do by a lawyer who sets out evidence. It's kind of different when it comes to medicine and science, that the onus and the bar seems to be much higher in people's mind, that because we've built so much through science communication, this idea that scientists are, you know, doing incredible, noble work, and that they're never wrong, and that, you know, if someone's discovered something in science, this is a discovery, makes it sound like it is now set in stone, we can write it into the steel. But actually, discoveries get overturned, they get retracted and so on. I'm wondering, are more nuanced approach to talking about science, has it actually eroded more our trust in science? Because before, we used to just tell people, this is the science and that's fact. And now we're saying, look, it's important to understand the scientific process, and there's errors that we make, and there's a, you know, there's a range of probabilities here. And people are now, it seems, certainly in places like United States and in small pockets elsewhere, I think, but, you know, very much it seems in the United States, much less confident in the results of science as a result of science being more open about how the scientific process works.
I think that is a good point. And it's this balance of, you know, you want some communication uncertainty, but you don't want to kind of almost push to excessive doubt. And something I've noticed, you know, even with students starting out, that often when students kind of start out in science, they'll see something in a journal. It's like, well, it's in a journal, it's in this prestigious place, it must be true. Yeah. And then I think they start to notice how science works. Like, okay, well, this paper has an error in it, and this has got a mistake, and maybe this is a bit uncertain. And then they kind of go in the other direction. It's like, well, how can I trust anything I ever read? And this is all just, you know, going to be flawed. And then usually they sort of settle down to, okay, you know, this is something where we can have a certain level of confidence. It might be overturned, but it can still be useful at the time. There's been some work, for example, looking at people who have questions about vaccines, and often people have very reasonable questions about vaccines. You know, sort of acquaintances during COVID would say things to me like, well, yeah, pharmaceutical companies have done some sketchy things in the past. They have. Yeah. You know, it's a reasonable question to have.
Yeah.
But there's been studies showing that, you know, having excessive certainty can actually backfire. If you tell people, you know, this is 100% true, and then it isn't, that then undermines that trust. And there is that kind of appetite for weighing things up. But it's something that's kind of, even going back through history, you know, in the 1800s, a lot of mathematics at the time had been built on kind of physical intuition about the world. So a lot of theorems that were said to be intuitively obvious because it was just people's perception of the emotion and how it worked in the world. And then when people started thinking more about things that were infinitely big or infinitely small, a lot of these theorems kind of built on physical intuition didn't hold up. And there was almost this kind of civil war in the mathematical community because a lot of the established figures were saying, well, these are just nuisance examples you're coming up with. Like, a lot of this stuff works overwhelmingly. You know, if you'd come up with all these nitpicking examples, like, you know, Newton wouldn't have done his work on motion and rates of change if you'd been doing that.
And stop being annoyed, essentially.
A lot of these things now, you know, whether you're talking about kind of astrophysics, you're talking about probability, you're talking about understanding the natural world, randomness, yeah, these are kind of crucial ideas in the modern world. But I think there was a sensible point that some of these established figures made, was, you know, it's really dangerous for someone setting out in this field to tell them everything you're doing might be or probably is wrong. And this, you know, Henri Poincaré, one of these mathematicians, said, it's not enough to doubt, we must know why we doubt. I think that's quite a nice line, that it's not enough just to tell people all of this might be wrong, but actually understanding, you know, how do we develop studies and how do we think about these things? And I think it's useful seeing emerging evidence that this is often a more constructive way. I think also understanding, you know, why, as you said, situations in the US, some of these things take hold. Because I think often, and I found that, you know, when I've given talks that cover conspiracy theories, and you get loads of comments on your talk underneath, a lot of it is, you know, is sort of overvaluing skepticism. And there's been a lot of work actually about news consumption in the last few months showing that I think we focus a lot on people believing falsehoods. But actually, if you look at news consumption, a bigger problem is people not believing stuff that's true. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there that's true news, and they're not engaging with it. And that's slightly different. And there's a risk almost that if we say, don't believe what you read, you're going to just drive people further into that problem.
Yeah, well, I often use the, you know, the question of diet is a perfect example of this, that that it's the reason why I think stories that are untrue get more prominent is often they're more interesting. They're often new. Like if you go to a doctor and they say, I would like to lose weight, they will say, well, you should probably reduce your calorie intake and exercise more, typically, right? That's a typically reasonable approach from a doctor. But if you go to that doctor the next week or the next month or in a year's time, they won't change their opinion on that. However, if you go to the internet and you say, I want to lose weight, there's a new, different, exciting idea that some celebrity has picked up every single week. And so there's the novelty factor. We're constantly, as a species, looking for novelty all over the place. And so it seems to me that's why we're attaching ourselves quite quickly to stories that sound interesting, but maybe aren't as reliable as the more obvious Occam's razor sort of approach to thinking. And this spill that we see, again, I'm focusing on America, but obviously not just America, of false information, where Donald Trump just this week stood up at a rally celebrating 100 days in office. And he said, you know, people overwhelmingly see that that the economy is going in the right direction. In fact, when his numbers were completely inverse, and actually people overwhelmingly think the economy is going in the wrong direction. But he went up there on the stage in front of a huge audience in Wisconsin, I think it was, and said, Michigan, he said, no, the opposite is true. And this is a huge problem with us trying to understand what is true and what is not true. How do we combat untruths when there's that sort of stuff that comes into our feed and challenges us when we're trying to say something that is true, but less interesting?
I think it's really the problem of our era. And I think understand the nature of kind of what we're dealing with is a key part. So there's been some nice work, for example, looking at, you know, asking people, do you want to share things that are inaccurate online? A lot of people say, no, I don't want to share things that are inaccurate. Then you look at that actual behavior online. And often what will happen, as you mentioned, things like novelty, strong emotional responses, things that align with our political beliefs often will kind of override what might be a desire for accuracy. So essentially, truth is just one of many competing factors. I think we also see more deeply the kind of interactions with power dynamics. I mean, I think probably in most offices around the country, there's somebody who's saying something that they don't necessarily fully believe because it's going to, you know, hopefully endear them to some endear themselves to someone in power. But also, you can have going against the grain as a demonstration that you're thinking independently and you're maybe being a bit kind of against the consensus. I mean, it's quite striking, I think, how many people who send scientists angry messages have kind of independent thinker and these kind of things in their bio. It's a bit of a kind of identity. Mm. And it's also not necessarily just one political group. If you look back over recent decades, in the 60s and the 70s, mistrust of scientific institutions was predominantly associated with left-wing groups. Mm. But it was kind of like mistrust of the establishment, and that kind of fed into that. And then now it's predominantly those right-wing parties where it's really tied in with your trust of institutions, your trust in systems. And so I think thinking of it just as a case of, oh, people are just falling for random bits of information is too simple. And actually, one of the things I've noticed a lot with kind of conspiracy theories is it's not just people have just fallen for a random thing they've done online. They actually put a lot of effort into misinforming themselves. And there's usually, if you ever get into a debate, there's huge amounts of information. And talking to people who work in these fields, I think we need to understand that that's what we're dealing with. And in some cases, it's also that search for an explanation. And I think often, you know, in some cases, the explanation is the world's a bit random and we don't really know. And having an explanation of like, there's a group of baddies and they're the ones causing this, and it all filters through in a much neater narrative. There's reasons, evolutionary reasons, we value it.
The book is called Proof, The Uncertain Science of Certainty, and the author is Adam Kucharski. Goes through lots of different use cases in which all through history we struggle to arrive at the correct truth and what we might do to do that better in the future. Adam, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.